Money Talk, the Annex Wealth Management Show, is hosted by Annex Wealth Management, a fee-only registered investment advisor. Important information about the qualifications and business practices of Annex is available at annexwealth.com. Different types of investments involve varying degrees of risk. Please consult with a qualified fiduciary advisor about your specific situation. Annex Wealth Management is a local fee-only fiduciary providing investment, retirement, tax, and estate planning. Know the difference. Financial planning at every level. Annex Ignite. Annex Comprehensive Wealth. Annex Private Client. This is Money Talk, the Annex Wealth Management Show on WTMJ.
SpaceX and jobs are the words. 135 and 172,000 are the numbers. This is Money Talk, the Annex Wealth Management Show. Great to have you here. I'm Joe Kraus, Chief Economic Strategist. Dr. Brian Jacobson is here as always. Hey, Brian.
Yeah, great to be here.
And CEO of Annex, Dave Spano.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. That's a really good setup. Let's start with the payroll report on Friday that we got from the government. It kind of matched what we saw on Wednesday from the ADP report. I do like looking at that ADP report because they do the actual payroll where the government is a survey. So yep. I usually on Wednesday when you see that number, it's usually a pretty good indicator of what you will see on Friday.
Yeah, it's really impressive the way that ADP, given that they do have that real-time reading of what payrolls are, that it can be a great indicator of what to expect with that employment report that the federal government releases. It is only on the private sector. And so with the federal government, you also get public sector. But it was interesting how we're seeing and have been seeing, I think ever since like November of last year, this building of some strength in private sector payrolls, especially smaller businesses and even on the manufacturing side. And we know that for a number of years, small businesses, manufacturing have effectively been in a recession. Mm-hmm. But that's where we've actually been seeing more of those gains.
And you talk about what we're looking at, and that's really a good thing that we're starting to see the smaller companies participate. I do want to talk about the large companies in a second, but this is good for the economy when you get a widening out and the smaller stocks and the smaller companies participating, because that is the largest employer in the United States are the small companies, not generally the large companies in aggregate. So let's change topics and talk a little bit about the large companies. The top 10 stocks continue to just overwhelm the market cap of the S&P 500.
Yeah, it's one of those things where if you just look on, let's say, CNBC, Fox Business News, Bloomberg, whatever your favorite channel is, and you see those major market indices, they're always talking about what's going on with the Dow, the S&P 500, the NASDAQ, and those are dominated by those biggest companies. And it used to be that the largest companies were a little bit more diverse. It could be some of them in like consumer staples, some in technology, some in industrials. But now those top 10 are predominantly in technology.
I think all 10 of the top 10.
You could easily make the argument, you know, there's this weird classification that they sometimes do where like Alphabet or Google, are they doing communication because it's like ad driven? Are they technology?
Or Amazon discretion.
Exactly.
But generally they're in the general tech area.
Yes.
So 10 of the top 10, if you want to make that argument, and that represents 40% of the entire index.
Yeah, that is incredible about how what's called concentrated these indices are. And that has been growing. Back in 2015, we had a little bit more broad-based exposure across the index, but it has been like just building in terms of the amount of concentration. And that's one of the reasons why what's really fascinating to see over this past week, where we've seen plenty of ups and downs, when you peel it back, if you just strip out the top 10 names, all of a sudden it's like, oh, there's areas like consumer staples, healthcare, real estate, where you're seeing strength despite maybe some red on the screen.
And that's really good because people see these headlines, but when you build a portfolio, you can't go, of course, everything into one particular sector. So you build a portfolio. Now, some active managers will trail the index because of the overweight, and we've seen that for a number of years.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes it's about you go through this fast and feast if you're just tracking the index, where if tech is driving it and all of a sudden you have like a company in there that's 10% of the index, most active managers are going to have risk controls where they don't want to have a position that large. Right. Maybe they do. So I'm not saying anything wrong with that.
Yeah. But as you said, and you were in that business before, right? There is governance that says you can't own that much percentage in your portfolio.
That's right. Yeah, just from a diversification perspective, the things that can make the portfolio look like it's doing really well can actually come back to haunt you if all of a sudden those concentrated names suddenly make a turn. And it does look as though that's maybe what has been happening. Now, who knows whether or not that'll actually continue? That's why it's important to not just invest based on the price. Sometimes it's said price chases price,
yeah,
right? Where you get this momentum, this
the
feeding
lemmings.
Frenzy. Yeah, and that's what can happen. Right. Yeah, like the old show, I think it was a Disney thing where they showed the lemmings and then they go off the cliff.
Right.
They apparently staged that, which is kind of sad that they would do that, right? But in terms of where they just follow each other and then all of a sudden, if one of them takes a turn, that's where you get what are sometimes called momentum crashes in the industry, where all of a sudden it can reverse and it can reverse hard.
Let me be clear. There were no animals hurt in the making of this radio show.
That's right.
So for sure, that is something. So let's put a bow on really what we saw on Friday morning with the jobs report. That has an effect on the treasury market. And of course, that is a big indicator of what happens with equities.
That's right. Because what we saw was almost a knee-jerk response, a really good jobs number, previous months revised higher as well. That suggests that the Fed maybe doesn't need to feel like they have to like run to the rescue to save the labor market. So it actually takes the possibility of rate cuts, lowers the probability of that. I don't think it makes a strong case for rate hikes, but you all of a sudden saw a big increase in the 10-year treasury yield. And as a result, then bonds suddenly become relatively more attractive to stocks in some portfolios.
And so we have a new Fed chairperson, and generally they get a little bit of a honeymoon, but Kevin Warsh is thrown right into the fire here.
I'm not sure if it's a honeymoon or if he's being thrown into a lion's den.
Right.
If you look at the way in which many of the people who vote on the committee, it is a committee decision, right?
Yeah.
There's 12 people who sit around the room. It is very divided. And one of the people who is a real champion for continuing to think that the Fed could and likely will cut rates, Governor Waller, he suddenly changed his tune just last week, where he was talking about, well, now given the strength of the labor market, persistence of these high oil prices, he thinks that there's actually be a stronger argument for a hike as opposed to a cut for their next move. Not
that's
to
crazy.
Say that that's
yeah.
imminent,
yeah.
but that that might be their next move. But the data can change.
Lastly, I do want to get to this in the last couple of minutes. If you think there's feeding frenzy now, wait till you see what Elon Musk is going to do. I mean, he's really cooking up a feeding frenzy.
Yes, he is. He is really trying to encourage more retail participation in this initial public offering of SpaceX. And that's where Joe at the outset said about 135 being one of those numbers. Apparently, they have set that as the target price for that initial public offering, which is a little unusual. Oftentimes, they will give a range. And then as the actual launch date, pardon the pun, comes for the initial public offering, then they'll narrow that down. But he's very confident that it's going to be 135, massive retail participation in this IPO. So I think that he's really trying to stoke the flames of some
for
enthusiasm.
Sure. And why that matters to the people who are listening, if they want to get some of that, they're not going to be one of the institutions who get a distribution of those shares.
Yeah.
But what happens is when it first starts to trade, all of the retail investors can go in and they're going to likely bid the thing up. I mean, I don't want to make a recommendation here, but
yep.
that is just the idea that he's trying to stoke this feeding frenzy.
Yeah, and we'll have to see if that enthusiasm actually plays out, because you have had it where some brokerage firms, you can put in your indication of interest and be like, yeah, I want to buy like X number of shares. But the allocation, the actual amount you might get could be a fraction of that if everybody else is trying to pile in.
And are you where you thought you would be with your portfolio? Annex not only follows the market trends on a daily basis, but can help you through the numbers with an experienced team that is all in-house. It took me less than 15 seconds to click the Get Started button at annexwealth.com. That's also where our free education is that we provide to our clients. This is Money Talk, the Annex Wealth Management Show on 620 WTMJ.
Custom-tailored investment and retirement planning from a fee-only fiduciary. Know the difference. This is Money Talk, the Annex Wealth Management Show on WTMJ.
Know the difference with Annex Wealth Management. Paying for college, one of the biggest financial challenges families face. A lot of different options, and the planning often starts earlier than many expect. From setting clear expectations with your kids to understanding saving tools, financial aid, loans. So we're talking with Rebecca Posick, financial planning specialist, about how to build smart, flexible strategies that support your child's future without putting your own financial security at risk. And you've seen quite a lot of this, Rebecca, over the years. Thanks for being on the show again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
When should parents realistically start planning and saving for college? I know that it's kind of a it depends question, but how do you decide how much to cover with your kids and how do you get them involved?
Yeah, before even thinking about the costs and the funding, I think it's very important for parents to think about their intentions for funding their child's education. On one end of the spectrum, I see some clients who want to pay for everything. And at the other end, some clients who don't want to pay for anything. And plenty of people that fall somewhere in the middle. And as you can imagine, it's very hard to come up with a plan if we don't know what the parents' goals are. So I've seen the most success when parents think about this early on. They have conversations with their kids earlier on in that college search process. So everyone in the family is very clear about what role the parents want to play and what's expected of the kids. One especially important thing to think about is whether they do want their kids to contribute. I think there's something to be said for kids financially contributing to their own education. They might take it a little bit more seriously, or it might be a little bit more impactful if they have some financial skin in the game.
529 plans. Maybe you've heard about those. How can families make the most of those?
These are one of my favorite college savings vehicles, and that's because they are so flexible. You can start these right away when the child is born, and just contributing a little bit each month can really make an impact over time when you have those contributions, you're investing them, and you have 18 years for them to grow. Now, I have heard from some clients in the past that they're nervous about locking the funds away in a 529 plan when they don't even know if their kids are going to college. But these plans are so flexible now. That's really been the trend over the last few years, and they can be used for apprenticeship expenses, K through 12 expenses, certain credentials. You can change the beneficiary, and sometimes you can even roll part of it over to a Roth IRA. So they're a great tool for grandparents to save. They're a great tool for legacy. There are so many advantages to these that it's really something I recommend for most people to consider.
Yeah, you at least want to start that 529 plan. We've done segments on unused 529 money, but keep in mind it can be used for education before college too. So how should families approach financial aid to kind of maximize their opportunities when it comes to that?
Well, something that I hear pretty often is that parents don't want their kids to have any student loan debt at all. And that's a great sentiment. Wanting to limit debt, especially at higher interest rates, is great. But one thing that I have to say is I wouldn't be afraid of taking on a little bit of student loan debt. A lot of times, and especially with the federal student loans, the terms tend to be a little bit more favorable than your average loan. So it's not necessarily a bad thing to take on a little bit of debt. It might even help the student build their credit score a little bit. And once you get your financial aid package back from a school too, you can see the loans on there. You can see what kind of grants or other opportunities they might have. And sometimes you can negotiate these a little bit. There might actually be a little bit more financial aid out there. So sometimes you can go back to the school and negotiate that.
So then how do you help parents weigh the cost of different schools? Because there's so many to choose from and a lot of different financial aid packages, like you just said, and against the long-term value for their child.
There are. And having conversations in advance about what are realistic schools and what are wish list schools. I've seen plenty of people whose kids apply to some very good and expensive schools. But in advance of that, they talk with their kids and let them know that it might just be out of their price range. On the flip side, I've also had clients who really wanted their kids to go to a more prestigious school. I had one where the parents had gone there and they really enjoyed their time and they wanted the same for their kids, of course. We were working on a plan so they could afford it, but we actually found out that one of the kids wasn't super excited about going there. They found a program they really liked somewhere else. They liked the campus life somewhere else a little bit better. What we really learned from that is it's not about the prestige. It's not even about the cost. It's about making sure the school is a good fit for the kid. Is it a place where they can actually grow and learn and be a good student? And that's what it's about at the end of the day. If the kid doesn't have a good experience there, if they're not succeeding, then was it really worth it?
She is financial planning specialist Rebecca Posig. Thank you for being on the show again, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Click the Get Started button at annexwealth.com.
Financial planning at every level. Annex Ignite. Annex Comprehensive Wealth. Annex Private Client. This is Money Talk, the Annex Wealth Management Show on WTMJ.
Hey, good morning. Welcome back. Chief Economic Strategist Dr. Brian Jacobson is here, and we're talking about the three-speed economy. So we're talking about the high, the middle, the low, and we like to talk about how it's the E-shaped economy.
Yeah, a lot of people have been talking about a K-shaped economy, the idea that there are those who are doing well and continue to do well, and there are those who are doing poorly and continue to do poorly. And it's actually probably not the right visual. Maybe in the letter E is a little bit better. So capital E, you've got them moving sideways because we have seen continued wage gains across the income spectrum, so high, middle, low, but it hasn't been enough to really offset recently the pernicious effects of inflation. So kind of moving sideways here. In terms of what we're really hearing from the Federal Reserve, they released their beige book, this collection of anecdotes from around the United States, and even from businesses, is really confirming the idea that there is a difference between those who cater to high, middle, and low income consumers.
And as far as these businesses, which ones are we looking at?
Yeah, so what we heard from, let's say, jewelry stores, so Signet, and let's think about Macy's, they were reporting some strength, especially at the higher income, where individuals, they're showing that they're resilient, and even in many cases, trading up where they're seeing value. Then in terms of middle income, that's where we're really seeing, let's say, as an example, this past week, we heard from Shake Shack, kind of viewed as it's not McDonald's, and it's also not, you know, like a steakhouse, more as kind of that middle of the road kind of restaurant. Their stock fell on some weak guidance because they were reporting about how middle-income consumers are delaying purchases, getting squeezed, and maybe trading down. And then on the lower income side of things, the first thing that pops to a lot of people's mind are probably some of these Dollar General, Dollar Tree, Five Below kind of discount retailers. And they did confirm that lower income consumers are straining, hunting for deals. And in fact, you're actually seeing a lot of migration, high income, middle income consumers finding deals when they're walking around those store aisles.
Everybody loves a coupon.
Yes, they do. Yep, couponing is cool again.
That's right. Financial planning at every level, Annex Comprehensive Wealth, Annex Private Client, and Annex Ignite. 9 total locations, and there's one near you. Another quick reminder with the Women in Wealth series, the live in-person event, Saving the Family Cottage. That's coming up June 18th, 6 to 8 p.m. at our Annex Wealth Management headquarters in Brookfield. Space is limited, so click Events and reserve your spot, maybe with a guest, at annexwealth.com. Glad you're here with us this morning. Time for news. Let's go to the WTMJ Breaking News Center.
Planning and investing insight from a fee-only fiduciary. You're listening to Money Talk, the Annex Wealth Management Show on WTMJ.
Hey, good morning. Welcome back. This is Money Talk, the Annex Wealth Management Show. If you haven't noticed, the 4th of July is going to be over in less than a month. And maybe you've seen it on social media. A lot of people talking about how America is turning 250. And somebody who has been following the economy all 250 years. Very old. Chief Economic Strategist Dr. Brian Jacobson. I know that you're a big history buff. Yeah. Of course, also forward thinking, following what could happen in the economy. So we wanted to kind of talk about America's economy over the last 250 years. Some of the highlights, yeah, things that have interested you or sure, that have had a big impact on our history.
Yeah, the highlights and also sometimes lowlights as well. And I think that's one of the key things is that when we look at American economic history, there are lots of twists and turns, right? And so what we're going to try to do is highlight what are some of the trends, some of the twists, some of the turns, and the lessons for today, because that's one of the reasons why I love studying history so much, is that a lot of what happened historically has determined what is in existence today. And plus, there are always lessons to learn from the mistakes and the successes of the past. And so I was kind of figured we might need to fast forward from 1776, signing of the Declaration of Independence, to closer to like 1789, because obviously there's a lot that happened during the Revolutionary War. But coming out of the Revolutionary War, 1789, Alexander Hamilton, he was the first Secretary of the Treasury. He had this rather radical idea about, let's take all of the debts that were incurred by the various states in financing the Revolutionary War and make it a common debt to the nation as a whole. And as you can probably imagine, that was a controversial thing because early on in the U.S. history, there was that debate, is it a confederation of states that are basically autonomous and we're kind of loosely tied together? Think about that's kind of what Europe is today. Or is it more of this federation, more federal level? And so this was kind of a big step towards that federal form of government by having this national debt.
And when you look at some of these folks in the foundation of our country and in our history, who really kind of stands out to you when we're talking about this time period between 1789 and 1836?
Yeah, so some of the big ones, obviously Alexander Hamilton. Then you also have with Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson. These are almost like everyday names. Maybe you don't say it every day, but just about any American, you can mention one of these names and they'll know it. So the assumption of the debt, $79 million worth of federal debt. And that basically said now wealthy people are going to have skin in the game, the success of the country, because if all of a sudden, instead of being a creditor, you know, at that point, like Delaware or whomever, if it's to the national government, you have the wealthy individuals who own the debt that they have a vested interest in making it successful. 1792, you had the establishment of the New York Stock Exchange. That was under the famous Buttonwood Tree. And so they did indeed meet outdoors at that point. But you also had a financial crisis at that point. And so Alexander Hamilton, using the Secretary of the Treasury, kind of stepped in, intervened to support the debt market. So this idea of national debt, the idea of that we need to be credible in saying that we are going to pay our bills, that dates all the way back to 1789. Intervention in financial markets. Well, that dates back to 1792.
And it'd be certainly interesting to see what those folks think about our economy now.
Yes,
with
it would be.
AI. Wouldn't you love to ask Alexander Hamilton about AI?
Have like a chat, Alexander Hamilton.
That's right, yeah. Click the Get Started button at annexwealth.com. This is Money Talk, the Annex Wealth Management Show on 620 WTMJ.
Money Talk is straight talk from a local fee-only fiduciary. It's time to know the difference. This is Money Talk, the Annex Wealth Management Show on WTMJ.
Know the difference with Annex Wealth Management. Well, over the last, I would say, couple of months, there's been a big buzz about SpaceX. You may have seen that a lot. You may have said that a lot. And maybe you've said the word trillion a lot, which is a number that doesn't come up on this show that often. And this is sort of historical. So to help us talk about the investment side of SpaceX, can you be involved? Should you be involved? Different things to look at, maybe things to kind of temper our excitement a little bit. Chief Economic Strategist Dr. Brian Jacobson is here. Hey, Brian.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So what are some of the things that you're seeing? Because it seems to change. Everybody has their own kind of feeling on this. Everybody wants to know, how much is the stock price? Can they be involved? Should they be involved?
Yeah. Oh, so, well, let's start with exactly what's going on. So SpaceX is a company that's majority controlled by Elon Musk. So he doesn't have a majority ownership of it, but he does have a majority of control. So that's one of the things that we learned from the Securities Exchange Commission filings, because anytime a company wants to go public, this IPO, initial public offering, they have to disclose a lot of information to the public before that can be approved. And he is basically, after it launches, going to still control about 40% of the company in terms of the ownership stake, but have the say over like 85% of the company. So it's kind of unique from that perspective, how much control he's actually going to have versus his economic stake in it. But in terms of the business itself, SpaceX controls not only Starlink, so perhaps you have heard of that alternative to if you have different fiber optic cable or the cable coming to your home for
internet service. Or if you're in a remote area.
Yep, exactly. So that's pretty unique, and that has been around for quite a while. So it controls Starlink. It also has a number of contracts in order to launch satellites. into space. So it works with the government. It works with private parties in order to launch rockets, launch these satellites into space. But now it also basically owns the company formerly known as Twitter, also known as X. And there is also this data center, couple data centers that it owns here on Earth. Part of the plan that they have disclosed is maybe they want to put some of those data centers in space.
You know? I'm curious. When we say the trillion valuation,
yeah,
who values that?
Right now, a lot of those numbers are really coming from some private market transactions. So there are people who own stakes in the company. And sometimes there are transactions between very large institutional investors or sophisticated investors where you can figure out exactly like how much did they trade at, and then you apply that to the overall firm. What they have released is that they have a target price of $135 per share, which is also kind of unique. A lot of times whenever they're going to be launching, and I keep saying launching because, you know, they launch rockets into space.
So it's a continuously good pun.
It is. It really is. They oftentimes will have a range where it might be between like $100 and $150. Yeah. And then in the run-up, as they do what's called the roadshow, so when they're talking to investors right before the initial public offering where it starts trading, they might narrow that down to a specific price. Well, Elon Musk and his lawyers and bankers, they came up with a specific price. So that's a little unique that they actually said, hey, $135. And so if you multiply that by the number of shares that are going to be offered, you would get something close to $75 billion. Okay, so $75 billion is what they're looking to actually raise from this. But if you apply that to the overall firm, you get to something close to $1.75 trillion, which is going to be, if it comes in at that price, qualify as the largest initial public offering in history.
And so that's why people get excited about it. But when it is going public, we're seeing a lot of companies not go public. Why is it going public?
That's a good question, because there's fewer and fewer advantages to going public now because there's so much private money that's available. We see the rise of private equity. This has been happening ever since around about 2000, 2002, where you've seen fewer and fewer companies deciding to go public because they can stay private. They don't need to raise the money. Most of the time, people would go public because they felt as though in order to raise more money, right, equity capital, the way you do that is on the stock exchanges. But they are deciding that maybe to provide liquidity to the people who own the stock, because it is cumbersome if you want to find another private party to purchase your shares. And so what this could do is those individuals who work for the company and have an ownership stake, it could provide them liquidity where there is now an active market. There's also other benefits to being public in terms of not just the liquidity that you provide current owners, but the ability to raise future capital. And let's face it, it's also kind of cool, right? In terms of the status around, hey, now it's publicly traded and there's a ticker symbol.
And I guess it would come down to, as far as people's individual portfolios, your risk tolerance. Do you want to jump on that bandwagon if it is available to you?
Yeah. And the way that I always look at it is anytime you see an initial public offering, remember, not all of them go to the moon. Some of them crash and burn.
Another pun.
Exactly. And so whichever one it does, we don't know. I think it depends upon how much confidence, how much faith you have in the story behind the stock. When we look at some of the fundamentals in terms of the financials, the revenue that they're generating, we know what it is or has been, what are their expenses, but then what's the growth potential here? And I think that's where some people are excited. It's like, hey, if they do launch data centers in space, if they do colonize Mars, if they do all these other things, right, that could be huge. And those are lots of ifs and buts that can pop up. And I think that's one of the key things to remember is that this is more about what's the story and then what's your conviction that they're actually going to be able to deliver on some of those expectations.
If you haven't noticed, Chief Economic Strategist Dr. Brian Jacobson is following the SpaceX IPO along with the investment team. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
Know the difference with Annex Wealth Management. Click the Get Started button at annexwealth.com.
Financial planning at every level. Annex Ignite. Annex Comprehensive Wealth. Annex Private Client. This is Money Talk, the Annex Wealth Management Show on WTMJ.
Hey, glad you found us. This is Money Talk, the Annex Wealth Management Show. This is also a podcast and is ready for you as soon as the show is over at the top of the hour. You can download it wherever you get your podcasts. The Axiom, that is our newsletter with our Week in Review video from this show and your email on Sunday morning, along with what we're watching for the week ahead. Getting a lot of questions about SpaceX. Just search Annex Axiom. Other podcasts, too, like The Wealthiest, Ideas, Strategies, and Decisions of the Wealthy in America. And the SWOT podcast, Strengths, Weaknesses, Opportunities, and Threats of the Current Market, with a new episode first thing Monday morning. And the new Women in Wealth podcast, featuring special guests helping to empower women through genuine conversations. CEO of Annex, Dave Spano, is here, and Chief Economic Strategist Dr. Brian Jacobson, drawing comparisons between 1999 and 1984, which a lot happened that year.
Yeah, 1984 was a great year. It really was. But in the media, they're talking a lot about how the market, the way that it's behaving, seeing tech stocks. Is this like 1999? And maybe it's a little bit more like 1984. Did you ever read in school the George Orwell book, 1984?
I didn't read that book, but I listened to Prince's Purple Rain a lot. That came out in 1984.
Oh, that was a great one, too. Yeah.
It was, like I said, it was a big year. Yeah.
So before we talk about the book, let's talk about why 1999. There's so many comparisons from the dot-com era. Yep. Versus what we're seeing today.
Yeah, so in 1999, that was really the acceleration of the market, but it was a lot of companies. You know, you had the internet, it was in its infancy, but you had businesses that didn't really have fundamentals behind them. It was all about the story, right? Story stocks is sometimes what they were called. And obviously that makes people a little nervous, like, oh, we're seeing tech stocks do so well. There's this new artificial intelligence technology. Is it similar? And the way that I've been looking at it is not necessarily in the Orwell sense in terms of 1984. So just a little spoiler alert, right? With the summary of the book, totalitarian state, about constant surveillance, use of technology. But I was actually thinking more in terms of that commercial from Apple, where they actually had it kind of this 1984 theme, where they wanted to disrupt, at that point, the dominant technology firm was IBM, right? Mm-hmm. Big Blue. Yep. And they come out and they're like, nope, we've got this better machine. And so, you know, they destroyed it and it was supposed to be liberating for people. And I think that's the tension right now. Some people are thinking about, oh, artificial intelligence, how is this going to be used? Is it going to actually concentrate further power in either governments or in big businesses? Or is it going to be a little bit more liberating? And when Jensen Huang of NVIDIA, he announced that NVIDIA, instead of just focusing on those GPUs, the graphic processing units that are used in these big data centers, that they're actually going to be launching some computers, some like personal computers. And I thought it was interesting, like, this could really be disruptive. Is it going to be empowering? Because what we've actually been seeing with the jobs numbers over the last few months is that there's an increase in number of small businesses that are being formed, where perhaps what it does is it allows entrepreneurs, people with innovative ideas, to use artificial intelligence to start competing with the
big. Yeah, and that would be the upside, of course, is that there's an expansion of the opportunities and not a contraction. Everyone's afraid that the computers are going to come over and take the world, right? We're going to have killer computers running around taking jobs. But you're seeing what's happening. And back to the beginning of the show, when we were talking about SpaceX, and people think about the rockets, but that's not what the play is with SpaceX. This is a compute play.
It really is. So most people, when they see SpaceX, they think about those rockets that just launch into space. They have some contracts with some private sectors to put satellites up, also with governments. But keep in mind, SpaceX, it also includes XAI, so the company formerly known as Twitter, right? That's part of SpaceX, but also these data centers. There's Colossus 1, Colossus 2, gigantic data centers. Part of the thesis here is, are they going to be able to put these in space? Because you don't need as much cooling because it's already cold up there.
Right.
Perhaps the power drain, it would be a lot less because you can put the solar panels on.
Clearly, I'm not smarter than Elon Musk, but there are cold places on the planet.
There are, yeah.
Right? Greenland jumps to mind that you could put it there. I just think there might be a hole in his theory.
I agree. I don't think that it's the be-all to end-all, but that is part of the pitch that he's making, is we're going to have data centers in space and also colonize Mars. When we were going through, anytime a company is going to have an initial public offering, they have to file all sorts of paper with the government. And part of that is this S-1. So it's the statement where they lay out sort of what's the business plan, what are the financials. And when you get into the details about his compensation,
That's where it's really fascinating, where he gets like a bonus if all of a sudden they have a colony on Mars with a population of at least 1 million. If that happens, he gets a bonus. It's really kind of a fascinating
read. Is the bonus motivating to him?
Well, yeah, because being a trillionaire, which he'll be the first trillionaire, is not enough money.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah, it's headed towards he's going to be the first guy with a T, which is really going to be a politically charged conversation.
It could be. Yeah, a lot of people talking about the concentration of wealth, especially in people who are pulling the strings of the technology that's dominant. How is it being used in terms of the relationship with the state as well? Plenty of concerns.
So let me get to just one more last thing about AI and the fact that a lot of these companies, these AI companies, are making money because they're starting to charge companies per seat. And I'm not sure all our listeners know that.
That's right. I think most people, they'll see that there's the free version that they can use, but it's limited as to what you can do. And then you can pay a monthly fee. Sometimes it's a usage charge. And that's where there's been a lot of coverage about the token cost. So the tokens is just one of the ways that they talk about what are the questions that you're putting in, what are the responses. And Uber, they came out, they said that, you know, a good part of their software is being supported and developed using artificial intelligence, but they've already blown through their entire year's budget in terms of these tokens. So this is going to be really fascinating as far as what happens when businesses actually need to start paying the cost. And so it's not just in this growth market capture kind of phase where it's a new technology, it's being given away for free, and now all of a sudden you have to start paying for it. The economics might be it's actually cheaper to hire a person than it is to pay for all these tokens.
And Joe, you know, we do monitor all these tokens. So I do see that, you know, when you ask AI how to handle a rotisserie chicken under our token system, that is part of the cost as well.
So I can't cook. I got to go to AI.
Maybe just put it in Google and don't use Copilot, right? Yeah, so you don't have to ask AI that question.
Don't come to my house for dinner. Another episode of Money Talk, the Annex Wealth Management Show. The podcast is ready right now on the radio station website, or just search Annex Money Talk. For Dave Spano and Dr. Brian Jacobson, I'm Joe Krause. Have a great week. Join us again next Saturday at 10 a.m. This is Money Talk, the Annex Wealth Management Show on 620 WTMJ.
Advice and opinions expressed during Money Talk, the Annex Wealth Management Show, are solely that of the hosts or guests of Annex Wealth Management and not WTMJ Radio or Good Karma Brands Milwaukee, LLC.